If we can just turn to page 7 of the slides, what is the fiscal framework and why is it so important? Lots of people use the term fiscal framework, but they're not really precise about what they mean about the fiscal framework. So some people will just talk about revenue and think that that's the fiscal framework. But if you look at the Money Bills Related Matters Procedures and Related Matters Act, you actually find that there's a very specific definition of the fiscal framework. So if you look at the next slide, it says that the fiscal framework means the framework for a specific year that give effect to the national executive's macroeconomic policy and includes parts A to D, so all parts A to D are part of the fiscal framework. So it says all revenue, budgetary and extra budgetary, specified separately, expected to be raised during that financial year. Okay, I have a question. What does extra budgetary mean, if I say budgetary and extra budgetary? Outside the budget, right, okay. Now, why would they specify budgetary and extra budgetary? Why would they make that distinction? Any ideas? Could be. Donor funds? Yeah. But now, why did they say budgetary and extra budgetary? Budgetary refers to monies that the country gets, but it's not appropriated through the budget, like, for example, donor funds. And the idea, yeah, but the reason why they did it is that they wanted Parliament to see all money available. Because if you don't say extra budgetary, what you start doing is you start leaving things out of the budget, right? And then Parliament won't know that money was actually there. Right, okay? So to make sure that your budget process is what they call comprehensive, right, okay? It covers all funds, even though you're not directly going to appropriate those funds, but at least you know it's there, and at least it must be audited. Does that make sense? Yes. Lying to Parliament, right? Okay, because all money that example, donor monies, you want a budget for, you want appropriated, because it will be a conditional grant from that government, but it needs to be in the fiscal framework. Just like if we go to B, estimates of all expenditure, budgetary and extra budgetary, specifically specified separately for that period. All expenditure of government must be covered in the fiscal framework, even though it is not necessarily budgeted for, right?
Extra budgetary for municipalities, for instance, be money that they get from the government for MIG funds, or because they haven't got the money, it doesn't come from their own funds, mm-hmm. and they haven't got the money to actually pay for it, but they budget for it, and it's got to be there so that the public out there knows that that money is there, but it's not coming from their rates and taxes.
Exactly. But you also find that there might be earmarked expenditures, like, for example, road levies, that get used for that specific particular purpose. It's covered by its own act. So it's not part of the appropriation process, not part of the budget, but it is a government revenue. So the whole idea is that your fiscal framework must actually show Parliament all the revenue and all the expenditure, whether it's in the budget process or not. Right? Okay, I think that's quite important. So there shouldn't be any slush funds that are created that's not on the budget, but it's not in the fiscal framework either. You want your fiscal framework to be comprehensive. And then it's your interest and debt service charges that we spoke to. And then I think the Honourable Member asked about where do we budget for the contingency reserve. If you look at D of the fiscal framework, there must be an indication of a contingency reserve necessary for an appropriate response to emergencies and or other temporary needs and other factors based on similar objective criteria. So the idea of a contingency reserve is that it mustn't be something that you forgot to budget for. It must be for something that you cannot budget for, like a natural disaster, etc. So if you look at the PFMA, there are certain sections in the PFMA for how you deal with emergency funding. Right? So if you go on to the next slide, you'll see the slide from the MCPPS, which is table 1.2, which says consolidated government fiscal framework. Right, okay? So when they say consolidated general government, that covers national, provincial, and municipalities, right, and public entities, right? So it's a very broad measure of government spending, right? And you'll see that there's revenue, expenditure, and budget balance there. If we look at our revenue, we can see that our revenue in 2012-13, which was forecasted in October, is supposed to be 890 billion in revenue, right, okay? And then it goes up to 2014-2015, right, okay? So what do we call 1,000 billion? A trillion, right, okay? So what you can see that now we're getting into trillions of revenue, right, okay? Now, you know, to me, the word trillion doesn't even seem real, right? But it is. A trillion of revenue. We'll have 1.1 trillion in revenue, right? Which will be 27.7% of GDP. So what this is saying is that if you look at everything produced in the country, 1 in 5 rand is basically going to go to government. Actually, 1 in 4 rand is a quarter, right? And if you look at expenditure, it's 1.2 trillion, right, in 2014-2015, roughly 51% of GDP, so it's roughly a third of GDP. And if you look at the balance, the budget balance, is it a surplus or a deficit? It is a deficit, right? Okay, and we know it's a deficit because your expenditure is much more than your revenue. So you'll see that the deficit in the MCPPS was expected to be 5.2% this year, decreasing to 4.5% and 3.3%, right? So given the discussion that we had earlier, that the growth projection is probably going to be down compared to where we thought we were going to be,
Now, that slide of the consolidated general government, right at the bottom, 2012-2013 and 2013-2014 and 2014-2015, on the percentage of GDP, how do we read those percentages? From minus 5.2 to minus 4.5, is it a decline? Or is it an increase? Are we saying that moving from 5.2 to minus 4.5, is it increasing or decreasing? What is the correct way of, without the talking about mathematics here?
Okay.
Because mathematics, I'm sure it will be said differently. Yes.
Okay. What you're saying is that if you look at the sign, is it positive or negative?
Negative.
The sign will tell you if it's a deficit or surplus. Okay, because it's a negative, you know it's a deficit. But if it was a positive, it would be a surplus. So what this is saying is that the deficit in the current year was supposed to be 5.2% of GDP.
Yes.
And the next year was supposed to be 4.5% of GDP.
Yes.
So you're still having a deficit in both years,
yes,
but the deficit in the second year is going to be smaller than the deficit in the first year.
Yeah.
It's better. It's a smaller deficit.
I know that it is better. What I'm saying is that the language that is being used. Are you saying is that it's increasing or decreasing?
Your deficit is actually decreasing.
Okay.
Fine. Right? Because... Yeah.
I think it's important that... At this point, when we look at these numbers, we talked about forecasts and who actually does the forecast, because these are forecasts. Right? Now, in 2008, I'm sure, Tanya, if you had actually taken those FFC forecasts for these years and put them against these, remember we did say something about the economy probably will only recover after 2015. To get back to where we were in 2007 before the crisis broke. Remember that discussion that we had in 2008 when we tabled our submission, which was not very well received by some people. But the fact of the matter is that the deficit is actually improving at a very gradual rate. The situation, if you look at those numbers, the situation has not improved. So the point that I'm trying to make, Chairperson, is that from where you're sitting now, the situation, even though those numbers must be showing, okay, the situation is improving, but look at where we were coming from to actually make a judgment of whether the economy is actually recovering, to be able to do what we were doing, because we had a growth path that we were looking at. And that growth path was disturbed by that. So we're still trying to work to get back to that growth path that we were before the recession. And so long as these numbers are still running below, and if you look at the graph that we put at that stage, you will actually see that this graph, it predicted that that's what is going to happen. But to catch up now, it's going to take a far much longer period. So which means in terms of those concepts that Tanya was talking about, your counter-cyclical policy, your expansionary fiscal policy, you still must actually come back to those issues and say, okay, what must government be doing now? So your public expenditure programs, these all things, basically, when I was saying the position that government takes, you must actually be seeing it in those numbers. You should be able to see government policy by just looking at the numbers and how government policy is responding to the changing economic environment.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, so if you look at these numbers, right, okay, because your growth figures are likely to be much, not much lower, but lower than what they were in October, your tax revenue will be lower, and therefore it's likely that your deficit will actually be higher than these numbers. Now, just note that, you know, when you look at your budget balance to GDP ratio, right, you know, you can decrease your budget balance, right, okay, but if your economy is also decreasing, then you might find that that ratio actually stays the same, because both the top and the bottom is actually decreasing. Does that make sense? Right? So let's say you've got your budget divided by your budget balance divided by your GDP. Now let's say that your deficit decreased by 10%, but the economy contracted by more than 10%. Then you actually find that ratio will increase, right? So the point that we're trying to make is that the amount of deficit that you can run depends on the amount of growth that you're getting in the economy, right? If you have an increasing deficit by 6%, but your growth is 8%, then that ratio is actually going to improve, even though you're running a deficit. Does that make sense? Right? So the more growth you have in your economy, the more sustainable your deficit is, right, okay? And remember that we said that the deficit is not necessarily bad. It depends on whether it's affordable in the long term and what are you trying to achieve with that deficit, right? So if you look here, you'll see that because you've got 3 years of deficit, right, is the fiscal policy expansionary or contractionary? Okay, when you run deficits, are you trying to stimulate the economy or are you trying to contract the economy? You're stimulating the economy, right? So therefore, because we're running these deficits, the fiscal policy stance is expansionary. If we were running surpluses, it means that it would be contractionary, right? Okay. So the question that we need to ask is it appropriate at this stage to be running an expansionary fiscal policy, right? And because the economy is so bad, it is actually appropriate to be stimulating the economy, right? And let's say we stimulate the economy, there's more jobs, that means that more people pay tax, the economy grows, then we can actually increase our tax and then we will start running surpluses that could offset the deficits that we're running now. So the point... Yes. And also, just remember that more people need grants and stuff when you have when the economy is bad. But when the economy picks up, then spending automatically decreases, like on unemployment insurance and stuff like that. So what you need is you need to have deficits, but then you need to run surpluses, and then in order to finance more deficits, right? Okay. So that's why we say that fiscal policy is counter-cyclical. We look at the business cycle. Is the business cycle recession or is it boom? And then we run our fiscal policy in the opposite direction, right? So when there is a recession, then we actually stimulate the economy. We run deficits, right? It's an expansionary fiscal policy. When the economy is booming, then what we do is we run surpluses. That, okay, so that we can kind of cool the economy down, right? What South Africa did before 1994 was actually the opposite. You know, when the economy was booming, they would be spending and actually amplifying that boom. And when the economy was contracting, then they would be cutting spending as well. So I think that after 1994, most academics and analysts will say that we've actually moved to counter-cyclical. So if you look at is the government doing the right thing at the right time, the answer is yes, right? But the question is, how long can they continue doing it? And the answer is you can't keep on doing it indefinitely. But you need to get back on, you know, towards a balanced budget and a surplus eventually. Right? Because otherwise you end up with a debt.
But what then informs closure?
I think that that's why forecasts are so important, right, okay? Because what economists are trying to do is to say, you know, what is going to happen to the economy, right? And they look at indicators. And you have things called leading indicators. So leading indicators are almost like an early warning system, right, okay? So they look at what these leading indicators are doing in order to guess or estimate what actually is going to result. But at the end of the day, policy is about judgment, because nobody knows what the future is going to be, right? Okay, so you have to make a judgment on, you know, if we spend too much, right? Okay, we're gonna run deficits and it's gonna make us unsustainable. But if we don't spend, you know, we might get unemployment. So how do you balance between your fiscal sustainability and your economic growth? It's basically that's where the Minister of Finance has to apply his or her mind about when we actually do these things and how much we actually do these things. The best way to monitor them is that the Reserve Bank publishes something called the quarterly bulletin every quarter, and they will say these are our leading indicators, and the leading indicators suggest that this is going to happen in the next year. And then you also have Bureau of Economic Research at Stellenbosch. They also do surveys where they ask businesses, what is your sentiment about the future? You know, are you investing? Are you cutting? So they use those perceptions to basically try and figure out what's going to happen in the future. But having said that, you know, it's not an exact science. And you find that two economists might sit with the same data but actually come up with different forecasts, because they have different views on how the economy works. So, the best thing to do is to listen to as many forecasts and views as you have out there, and then try and formulate an opinion. Okay?
So the other thing is also that, I mean,
you can't look at the lead indicators for South Africa in isolation to the global ones, because the mere interrelationship of the South African economy and dependence to quite a significant on the global economy basically means that most of those indicators in South Africa react to what is happening abroad. So even when you look at the global economic crisis, when it hits the world and when it actually hits South Africa, there's a lag. So when you respond, you probably, when those other countries are basically now on the up, you probably now starting to, so that also acts as a buffer, because on your export side, something will be kicking in as those countries respond. And then that also creates an interesting dynamic to look at. So you don't look at the globe and say the globe is in a crisis, so South Africa is in a crisis. It does not follow like that. There's a lag.
Yes, I just want to know, please educate me a little bit on this. I have always wondered how the economy of Greece, for example, is having such trouble, and yet the countries under the same monetary union, not all of them are going through the same. What is it that determines that this country, even though using the same currency, is going down while the others are floating?
Okay.
What would be the reason?
I think it's, you're actually coming to one of the very controversial issues, because monetary union is when they share the same monetary unit, okay, like the euro. Mm-hmm. But fiscal union is when they coordinate their budgets. Okay. Now, when they did the euro, they did monetary union, but they didn't do fiscal union. Right? And now people are saying it should have been the other way around. There should have been fiscal coordination first, or at the same time as what monetary is concerned. So even though they can still be using the same currency, the decisions on the budget, how much you spend and how much you, how much tax rates, those were set independently by those countries. Right? Even though they were, it was all denominated in euros. That's okay. So it's kind of, but it's not the same, but it's like Namibia. We use the same currency, but they set their own budget, right? So it's quite possible to have Namibia in a surplus, or Swaziland, or Botswana, or whatever, or the land monetary union. Okay, so just coming back to that diagram, the diagram on table 1.2. There's that expenditure, right, okay, which was 1.062 trillion in 2012-13. If you look at the next slide, you'll see table 1.3, and what that is doing is taking that 1.062 trillion for 2012-13, which is the same numbers, right, the total expenditure is the same numbers from the previous, but it's splitting it by function, right, okay? So you can see in more detail what's being spent on what, right, okay? So you can see that your contingency reserve in 2012-2013 is 6 billion, and then it increases to 24 billion, right, at the end of the MTF period, right? And you'll see that there's science and technology, there's social protection, which is grants and social welfare services, education, recreation, health, local government, economic services, economic infrastructure, public order, defense, etc. Right? Now note that this total expenditure, and then we put our state debt cost, right, and then we say non-interest expenditure. Right? Now you'll notice that government has got no control over the state debt cost in the short term. Why? Because you have to pay that interest. Because you pay interest now because of contracts that you signed or bonds that you did in the past, right? So that's why your interest expenditure is non-discretionary. You can't affect it in the current year. Does that make sense? Like I said? So if you want to see what government has got control over, you can look at your non-interest expenditure, right? You see, when government normally hedge, government can, but when they hedge, they will normally hedge against currency fluctuation. But because most of our debt is actually denominated in rands, there isn't really hedging. Do you understand what I'm saying? And even if there was hedging, you'd have to pay, right? You have to pay for hedging, and that would then be an additional cost. So the point that I'm trying to make is just look at the state debt cost, right, okay? It's 89 billion in 2011-12-13, and then it increased to 115 billion. So it's actually growing at 14.4%, right? So that what this is saying is that your total expenditure is growing at 8.4%, but your debt is growing at 14.4%. So it's growing much faster than the total growth of expenditure. Does that make sense? Right, okay? But now look at non-interest expenditure. Non-interest expenditure is at 7.9%. So that means that it's actually growing slower than total expenditure. Does that make sense? Right, okay? So what happens, this is why having too much debt is a problem, because it means that your interests are almost like top slice, because you don't really have much control over it in the year, which means that the amount that you have for discretionary expenditure is basically less and less, right? You mean the amount of it?
This is done.
the point that he's making is that you need to look at the size of the allocation and you need to look at how fast the allocation is growing. So what he's saying is that the size of the allocation is so negligible that it might not be appropriately prioritized. But if you look at the growth rate is how much of science and technology of the MTF period? It's 9.5, right? Okay, and is it growing faster than average expenditure, the total expenditure, or less fast? It's growing slightly faster than the 8.4, which is the total expenditure, but it's better for us to actually look at 7.9, the after-interest expenditure. Because remember, the total expenditure contains interest payments, which is not under the control, right? Okay. So when we look at whether something is a priority, we need to look at the amount, the proportion of the total budget, and how fast it's growing. Right? Okay. So, for example, education might only be growing at 6.7%. That's actually below the non-interest expenditure, but it's off a very high base, correct? Because it is already like something like 40% of your non-interest expenditure anyway. Okay, so that's what the fiscal framework is. The fiscal framework is basically the size of the cake. Right? How big is the total expenditure? How big is the total revenue? And then once you have that, you start cutting slices of the cake. Right? Okay? And that slices of the cake is basically the division of revenue, the DORA. Right? And so, you know, if we go and we just look at some of these issues, I think that, you know, we have to start out by saying that, look, we've got a government where we've got three spheres. And while policy is set at national level, most of the implementation is actually in your municipalities and in the provinces, right, okay? So it's very important to actually look at, you know, once you've got the total cake, you know, what percentage of the cake does national get, does each of the provinces get, and each of the municipalities. Bear in mind that there will never be enough money for everybody, right? Because the expenditure needs will be always will be greater than the amount of resources available. Right? So you're never going to satisfy everybody. But given what you have, are you allocating that in as equitable measure way as possible? Right? Okay. And so if you look at how money flows between the different spheres of government, that's intergovernmental fiscal relations, right? And that's obviously where us as the FFC come in. So when we look at intergovernmental relations, we have to look at who's actually making the policy, right? Who's setting the national norms and standards for basic education or health or social development, right? Okay? And then we need to look at, okay, who implements the policy? Because national government might set the policy, but it might be the provinces or municipalities that actually implement it. Very importantly, we need to know who finances the implementation, right? Okay? Because, you know, if national is setting the policy, but province has to implement, who has to fund, right? Okay? And you often find that it's on the funding issue that things become unstuck. So you might find that national introduces certain policies, but they actually don't fund them, right? Or they leave it to provinces or municipalities to have discretion to the level that they're going to fund or not. The problem is that you can have the best policies in the world, but if you don't have funding and it's not well implemented, you're actually not going to get achieve the policy objectives that you want to. And I think that this is what makes service delivery in South Africa so difficult, because our constitution says that, you know, one sphere of government might be doing policy, others might be funding it, right, okay, and others implementing. So you must actually, like, coordinate all of these things, right, okay, because the minute you don't coordinate these things, that's when your service delivery doesn't happen. And when different people are doing different things, the question becomes, who's accountable? Right? So, for instance, if a policy is not implemented, the provinces could say, yes, but that's because the policy was badly designed, right? Or it wasn't funded properly, right? Okay. So I think that finding accountability in a very decentralized system is actually quite difficult. So, you know, intergovernmental fiscal relations sounds quite academic, and the question then becomes like, when or why should we care about it? And I think that it's important to realize that how we structure these intergovernmental fiscal relations really can either create incentives for service delivery or disincentives for service delivery. It can either be efficient and equitable or it cannot be, right? Okay? And when your delivery and your budget allocations are not equitable, it means that you're going to get growing gaps between standards of living and services in different provinces, in different municipalities. And then also issues like transparency, participation, diversity, all of those things also play a role in how we structure these finances. So, you know, it does, you know, when we look at the Division of Revenue Act, it looks very technical, but it does actually impact on quality of life and quality of service delivery in different provinces. And I think that this is why Parliament is actually interested in it. So, if you look at who spends what, for provinces, you'll find that they share a lot of the responsibilities with national government. So if you look at health, education, social development services, you'll find that those are actually in Schedule 4 of the Constitution. And in shared competences, you normally find that the policy is set by national, as I said, but the actual schools, the actual hospitals are run by the provinces, right? And then you get exclusive provincial functions, which just the provinces do. That would be things like provincial planning. And so what you find is that there's a set of functions that provinces do. And in the same way, if we look at municipalities, we've got 278 municipalities. Municipalities share certain functions with national, like public transport, municipal health, air pollution, electricity, where the policy is set at national, but the implementation is mainly municipal. And then you also have exclusive local functions like cleansing, refuse removal, solid waste disposal, etc. Right? What you also find is that when provinces spend their budgets, exercise their activities, they need to do it in a way that doesn't impact on other provinces. If there are those impacts, these national government overrides, for example, Section 100 in regard to provinces, and if municipalities fail to fulfill the executive responsibilities, then a province can intervene, Section 139, and if the province doesn't intervene, national can intervene in the province place, that would be Section 139.5. Okay, so what we see is that most of the money, tax money, is collected by SARS at national level. But most of the implementation actually takes place at provincial level or municipal level. Right? So can you see we have a problem? There's a gap between the expenditure responsibilities of provinces and the revenues that they can raise, because they can raise very few own revenues. So economists call this gap a vertical fiscal imbalance. Right, okay? And so we need to find a mechanism to actually take those nationally collected revenues and to allocate it to the provinces and municipalities and national governments so that they can fulfill the expenditure mandates. Right? And that process is called the revenue sharing process, and every year the outcome of that revenue sharing process is enacted in the Division of Revenue Act. Right? So if you look at SARS collects personal income tax, company income tax, and value-added tax, and those are really your lucrative buoyant taxes. Your provinces only collect car licenses, hospital fees, gambling proceeds, right? And that only really accounts for about 5% of their total expenditures. If you look at local governments do have property rates, and they have user charges on electricity and water, but on average, they only collect about 75% of the budgets that they spend. It obviously varies across municipalities, because you'll find like your metros, like you know, Isiqueni, the city of Cape Town, they will basically raise about 95% of their own revenues. Whereas you find that you get smaller rural municipalities that almost depend totally on the grants that they get. So 75% of total expenditure. You can look at the local government. You can look at the local government budget and expenditure review that Treasury publishes. It used to be 90%. In about 2004, local government used to spend about 90, used to raise about 90% of their own expenditures, but now it's actually decreased. Excuse me?
It was the kind of municipalities that we have been running around that
yeah, no, I
think that they are wholly dependent on.
Yes, but I think those figures look at. Those figures actually look at the municipalities in aggregate. So there are those municipalities that actually, like the ones that we saw in the Northern Cape, and there are quite a number of similar ones in the Eastern Cape. So I mean, you can look at them at an aggregate level, and then you can then split them into the different types, because there are different typologies of municipalities that you can get. But part of the report that we put together on the when we did our public hearings on the local government fiscal framework basically confirms that there are quite significant differences. So within the local governments, so there are some. I mean, talking, I had a meeting with the city of Joburg. They are still playing around about 91%. So, but when we look at the average today, compared to maybe 6-7 years ago, it was around about 98 for specific metros, like your Eteweni was I think 96 or something like that. So the equitable share was a very small amount of money. Conditional grants were also like just beginning to fit into the process. Now, there are reasons that one picks up around those things, but I think part of the reasons that one has actually gotten to pick up in terms of the decline in own revenue contribution to the expenditure of municipalities has been the changes that have taken place, whether it's the RIC levies that were removed and replaced by grants, or the sharing of the fuel levy. There have been a whole range of other responsibilities that have actually landed in municipalities from an administrative point of view that actually have increased the expenditure responsibilities of municipalities. We worked out when we did our submission, last year's submission, we worked out for the metros, I think it was close or not, over 4 billion or something in unfunded mandates. Across a variety of them. So the expenditure responsibilities have increased for municipalities and more specifically for certain categories of municipalities. Whilst the revenue sources in your district, for example, the revenue that most districts are raising actually gone down quite significantly. It now grants. So that's explains why that figure has come down from around about 90 to about 70 something.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but if you split them, if you disaggregate the municipalities, the picture changes quite substantially. So you will have your mills now where the mills fit in. I mean, I'm sure the Honorable DPA is gone, but you yeah. So if you disaggregate them, then you will find that even the approaches that we have of dealing with them, even the revenue sharing formula mechanism might no longer be appropriate to actually deal with those kinds of issues. We need to just relook at how we treat municipalities, because the differences are just significant.
Shouldn't we then when we take up national sphere, and then we take the provincial sphere, and then we take these metros,
dealing with all these other local governments other than the metros at the bottom, so that we actually apply appropriate figures to them.
Yes.
Because surely what I'm reading with the 75%, which I dispute, but with your explanation, then I'm being cornered. But
I was hoping
but the fact of the matter is that the capacities of metros are the ones that are actually hiding the truth.
Exactly.
Yes.
The truth about the local municipalities on the
yes.
ground.
Yes, but
and hence we must separate them to be able to respond
yes.
appropriately. To
yes,
them.
Yes, and that's exactly my point. That when you take them as local government.
Yes.
And aggregate it like that, you are actually not, you are going to miss the nature of the problem that you are dealing with. You're going to miss the nature of that problem. So there's a need to actually rethink the way in which we are approaching it. I must say that there's some work that is currently ongoing around this particular matter, both from the Treasury and Department of Cooperative Governance perspective. But you see, these things, they tend to take a little bit longer than, and by the time we actually get to a point where the problem would probably the impact that we make, because at the same time as you speak, we can start moving and saying metros. But frankly speaking, you cannot take the city of Johannesburg and put it against Buffalo City, for example, and say these are metros. You can't actually put those together like that and make a serious comparison and say this one is a metro and this one is a metro, because the problems that they're dealing with are completely different. Johannesburg is dealing with a problem of infrastructure that cannot actually cope as simple as you can get with the Johannesburg's problem. But if you go to the other Buffalo City or Mangaung, in its current configuration, it's serious issues there that it's dealing. So it's important that as we think about these things, we actually think about the impact of delaying the decisions, and also the impact of the decisions that we take when we do take them.
Okay, I just want to summarize for Honorable Sabir what the discussion was. I basically, in one of the earlier slides, I said that on average, municipalities cover 75% of the expenditures from own revenue, and this is down from 2004, where it used to be 90%, right? And then Honorable Mashili was saying, surely that figure can't be correct. It's too high, given that there's so much evidence of grant dependency. And what Bongani was pointing out is that 75% also includes all of the metros. And so the metros, because they're so large, they actually skew everything, so they drive up that average. So once you actually take out the metros, you'll see that number will actually just drop. So the point that Bongani was making is that, you know, when we design our fiscal framework, we can't just look at averages. Because the metros really skew everything. And only once we take out the metros, then we get a true picture of... we need to look at the different categories of municipalities to kind of see, like, you know, what is the true situation. Okay. Yeah, sure.
Because we have Baltimore municipalities, that's a good enough reason to dismantle regional municipalities totally, because they get funding from government only, from no other source, and they can split that money to rural municipalities and give it to them.
Pongani?
I was going to say that, you know, that's part of what I was saying, that it, you know, it's not about dismantling or saying let's do away with this. It's about how do you make it. It's about how do you make it work. Now, there's an entity called the Demarcation Board that's actually entitled or entrusted with looking after those kinds of issues, questions of whether a municipality is viable or not. Now, from where we see it, we pick up a lot of problems. We can't talk about the viability of a municipality or non-viability. We talk about a municipality in its existence. Now, what we can do is to partner, because we basically now signed an MOU with the Demarcation Board, and there's a specific project that we actually will be looking at with them in this particular year. Hopefully, by the time they complete their re-demarcation process, we will have reached some form of understanding about some municipalities. I agree that some municipalities, really, there is no point. There's this municipality, that's your municipality. You wake up in the morning, this municipality owes water, it owes electricity. There is nothing that it doesn't owe in the first place. And the second thing is like they can't pay their staff. So the first response is to say let's close down this municipality. And then what? So you need there's a step one before you get to that. So that's the thing that we will be doing with the demarcation board on these kinds of issues. I think it's important that's been done.
Okay, so just talking about the division of revenue, how does it specifically happen? Well, first, government looks at all the revenues that they are likely to get from SARS, and then they add the amount that they're going to borrow for the year, right? And that basically gives them the total pool that's available. Then what they do is they top slice interest expenditure and debt service expenditure, because that are contractual obligations outside the control of government. Okay? So then once you've taken that pool and you subtract your interest expenditure, what's left is the amount that's available to be split across the three spheres, right? And then it's split national, provincial, and local, right? Okay. Does anybody know what do we call that split when you take the pool and you split it national, provincial, and local? The vertical division, right? And then once you get the pool that's going to provinces, you split it by means of a formula. That's the horizontal division. You get the pool that's going to local government, municipalities, and you split it among the municipalities. That's called the horizontal division, right? So you've got the vertical division and the horizontal division. The vertical division across the three spheres is basically a political decision by cabinet. But the horizontal division, where you take the pool and you give it to each of the provinces and to each of the municipalities, that's done by means of a formula, right? So you can actually kind of look at what the variable in the formula is, and it's a bit more transparent how that decision was made. Yeah, among all of the municipalities and among the nine provinces, right? So just to look at it in numbers, okay, go on.
Who used the formula? The formula for the vertical split?
No, there is no formula for the vertical split. That is actually one of the contentious decisions, because what will happen is that at Budget Council, which they had yesterday, the Minister of Finance will listen to spending pressures, listen to what the provinces have to say, listen to what the municipalities, and they will decide what that vertical division is. Right?
Okay. Yeah. Now, the next question is for the vertical division, then you've got this contingency there.
Yes.
The contingency is there
actually taken off. It's taken off.
It's taken. It's stopped.
It's actually not part of the division of revenue. What you do is you look at the total revenue pool that you have. You then say, out of this pool, I am going to cut this slice and put it aside. This is my contingency reserve. That will deal with my debt service costs. This will deal with my policy changes and whatever. So you take it out completely. Now, the cake that you are now sharing is less than contingency reserve.
So the contingency reserve, what I'm trying to get to...
What is that amount?
To deal with them vertically.
Because surely when you divide the cake horizontally, there may be mishaps as well.
Yes.
But how do you then deal with those? If you find that maybe something arises in 3 days, that will arise that you should have chopped from the other provinces to actually take out of that because they experience something that is that the other province. Is that kind of thinking also exist for horizontal division?
No. What happened is that the vertical division, that contingency reserve, so all your natural disasters, where it declared the national disaster, that fund will basically deal with that particular process. So there is no horizontal issues around contingency. So some provinces in their own provinces actually used to keep a certain amount on the side to deal with those contingencies. But at some point, because it's such a controversial thing, where do you put it and who takes the decisions on it? It's an executive decision. But the potential for abuse and corruption, because it becomes a slash fund, basically. That's what it amounts to. It becomes a slash fund. So you want to try your best, the best as you can, to keep some degree of transparency. But this the vertical division, like I said, like Tanya said as well, it's a contentious decision that was taken that you can't actually have the vertical division being done by a formula or, let's say, people that have got no political. If you are not a representative politically speaking, you're not representing anybody. So an institution like the Financial and Fiscal Commission has no point actually making any stories about the vertical division. You can analyze it and see where it's not working, but to say this is how it should be split means you're taking accountability politically. So that was the biggest discussion around whether you can apply a formula to the vertical division. The commission actually has a formula that it designed when it made its first set of recommendations on the division of revenue. But it was agreed at Budget Council that can't be a technical decision, because that's what it means if you actually give it to the commission. There's some political decisions that must be taken around that.
Can we just look at numbers, what I told you in words, right? Okay.
Sorry, Tanya.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, you remind me, you spoke about today, being allocated to deal with the unfortunately unallocated expenditure.
Mm-hmm.
When you check at the adjusted community expenditure for your assessment budget, the main issues that are raised in the section of unfortunately mainly the salaries for the public sector increase, unexpected increase in salaries and housing subsidies in the public sector. And my question is, how does that affect the public sector? Because to me, the example that Mr. Roman is making is mainly focused on the
Yeah, can I say that you see when the budget is done for, let's say for example for 2012, it's actually done before the wages are settled, right? So the settlements for 2011 happened in 2012 or whatever. So that negotiation basically means that provinces will okay that amount of money. But now I think we need to separate, because the kind of problems that we are faced with respect to the personnel budget is that you actually have that process of the wage settlement that will be the gap between what would have been given as an indicative and what ultimately gets agreed to. You would recall that in the past year, the minister basically decided that we're not going to fund fully what is agreed to as the final settlement anymore, because what was tending to happen is that certain provinces would actually fill in positions, and I think I did speak about it in the morning. You fill in a position which is not funded. You might have a structure that's approved, but in any one year, if the positions are not funded, to actually fill in that position is unauthorized expenditure. But some provinces were actually doing that, and come the revised estimate period, they will actually then, now this becomes unforeseen and unavoidable. So it was almost like becoming institutionalized. And so by the time you pick it up, you find that now your personnel budget has been running away from you. And it's decisions that are taken by officials, which means they are not unforeseen and unavoidable. They're actually taken by officials. It's a different thing when a decision is taken at a bargaining chamber. Now, as the Eastern Cape, I have no control at all on what the unions and their employer settle on. I just have to make sure that I implement once the agreement has been reached. So those are two different dimensions. It's not just so you employ people under normal circumstances, so you've increased your staff, but you did not budget for them, because you don't appoint when there is no budget. It's in terms of the PFMA, you actually already done authorized expenditure. Yes, but the problem is that it's not a national treasurer responsibility to take action. It's the accounting officer for that department and the executive authority for that department that must actually take action, because it's a purely departmental issue. I mean, there's been some discussions that we've been having with the national treasury, for example, around some of these OSD kinds of things, where we were thinking that maybe it's better to separate it from the rest of the personnel transfer. But there's a problem. There's also a problem with the, you know, provincial treasuries, for example, trying to get into these discussions who gets appointed in a department and approved. So in some provinces, they've decided to go that route, that you can't actually hire before you check with the treasury, that you actually demonstrate to the treasury that you actually have the money for that position. You can't. But the thing is, like, in some provinces, the treasury that has tried to do that has been told in no uncertain terms that you are not the guardian of this department. So we will do what we want to do in our department, and you do your job. This is our mandate. So you have those types of practices, and how do you deal with them? You know, you might want to say, you know, let's take a tough stance across the board. So even those that are doing the right thing, might actually feel because of the others. Maybe they will start talking to each other. But I mean, these are very difficult issues that border around what provinces believe the mandate that they have is, and whether to what extent at the national level, when you have certain priorities and certain pressures that you are dealing with, to what extent can you enforce those on the executive authorities in a province, because they also have their own executive authority. So that, those are issues that are on the table that we should be discussed. Yeah. No, if there was no tight fiscal framework, I must say these were not going to be very serious issues.
Exactly.
So that's how they got institutionalized. We had this lots of money around, and so people could actually play around with this thing.
Okay, can we look at Table 8.1, Division of Nationally Raised Revenue? And I just want to walk through in numbers what that tells you verbally. Because I really don't like the way Treasury presents their numbers. It's actually very confusing. But let's look at 2011-2012, right? The total expenditure for that year is $888.923 billion. Can you guys see that?
Yeah.
Okay. Now that is basically all the borrowing and all the tax that's available in the country. Then what we do is we top slice the debt service cost. Can you see that debt service cost, 76579? So that gets taken off, right? Okay. And what you have after that is 812345. Can you guys see that?
Yeah.
Right, okay. Then, from that, we subtract unallocated expenditure of 40 and the contingency reserve of 4090. Right? So as Bongani says, that even comes before the division of revenue. Right, okay? And once we subtracted that, we'll end up with 808254. Which is under the total column, right? That total column is split then into national share, which is 380, provincial share, which is 357, and a local government share, which is 70 billion. So if you add those three up, you end up with 808254. Does that make sense? Right? That local government allocation of 70 billion can be split into equitable share, which is 34 billion, fuel levies, which only the metros get, and conditional grants, which is 27.49. Right? Okay. So what is the difference between a conditional grant and the equitable share grant? What's the difference between the equitable share grant and the conditional grant? Basically, your conditional grants are for national priorities,
yeah.
like basic services. But the question is, is your equitable share appropriate? Because if your equitable share is not appropriate and you don't have own revenues, then obviously, people are going to use the conditional grants for things that they're not supposed to. Can we look at the percentage shares there? As the last three lines, right? Okay. What this is saying is that of that 808 billion in 2011-2012, national departments got 47%, provinces 44%, and local government 8.7%. Right? Okay. So what can we say about the trends? It remains virtually the same, but local government share, is it increasing or decreasing? It's slightly increasing. Provinces? Decreasing or staying the same? Yeah. Yeah. And in national departments? Yeah, it's static or decreasing slightly. So the point is that... Yeah. But if you compare this to 50% in 2019, what we can see is that there's actively savings happening in the national sphere, which is being sent down to provinces or local government. I mean, but as you say, it's basically almost static. The national government can decide how to allocate this fund. Well, if they keep it for themselves. Well, the point is that if you look at the control of it, because it's sitting under national government control, but bear in mind that if it's a disaster or something, it could happen in a province, so the province could use more of that. I think the question is that we tend to raise the issue about the contingency reserve in the budget, but we don't go back and say, well, last year, how did you actually spend your contingency reserve? There's no reconciliation of actual expenditure back to that contingency reserve.
My argument, although it may look a little bit stupid, is that the percentages at the bottom
mm-hmm.
should reflect the split and the control of funds for expenditure delivery of services. Now, the percentages in relation to national departments looks to be stagnant or flat, as if there is no growth in it. But whereas the actual funds at the national level actually increases, but hidden in the form of unallocated as well as the contingency reserve. Because in any way, even if it's not allocated to a national department, but surely that money is available at national level and is controlled by national, not the province. You see. Well, it will depend on the begging of provinces or whatever, but somebody has the right to agree. Like if national refuse to declare Mpumalanga as a disaster after this rain, you know, you can't say Mpumalanga has got control over those funds. It doesn't. Therefore, the share is not part of province, you know. Irrespective of who uses it, I mean, even departments, sometimes they get their allocation at national level, thrown to provincial departments to do something else. The question is the control, because the control then relates to the planning and the delivery of service. But if you don't have control over it, then that fund is not available for you. Thanks.
I think that's a good point. Might be interesting to ask Treasury to comment on that. They're just looking. Only for me.
Thank you.
Well, a lot of district municipalities also feel that way. And that's one of the reasons that that figure that we talked about that used to be 90% has actually declined to 75%.
No, maybe just also to add that even the metros themselves, if you actually speak to the city of Johannesburg and say, what would you prefer, to have the RSC levy or to be sharing the fuel levy, they'll probably tell you that would prefer to have the RSC levy, because in terms of what they wanted to do to actually reform it and make it work, they were projecting far much higher revenues. Also, the fact that they would have been controlling it, it's within the control of the... This is not to say that the fuel levy surcharge sharing is a bad thing. It's a replacement for those RSC levies coupled with the grant for the other municipalities. Now, the question that should be asked is whether that fuel levy is a sufficient replacement for the RSC levy, and whether that grant that is now given to those other municipalities who are not metros is a sufficient and buoyant enough replacement for the RSC levy. That is the question that at the commission's level we are actually dealing with. I must say that for some municipalities, for example, at the moment we're dealing with an application by the city of Etowah for a local business tax. Just reading in the papers, what I read in the documentation on the application and what I read in the papers around what the reaction of the business community is, basically makes me take a step back and ask whether the business community in at a national level is not the same as the business community at a city level. So if the business community in Etowah is happy with the local business tax, why would the national business community not be happy with that? So we must ask those questions, because there are questions that are being asked, and from where we are sitting, we need to actually find some responses. We need to make some recommendations around that. And I'm sure if you read what I think it's the Business Unity South Africa, the CEO there, a day ago, he was actually saying a whole range of stories about why it cannot be that municipalities must get more revenue powers because they already... So these are issues that we must deal with, we must confront. But I'm glad that you are raising the issue that there's an issue with the RSC levy and revenue for municipalities.
I must say that was one of our least...
The problem with the RSC levy is, you know, if you go to a small town like Willem Mall or wherever, there's no income from RSC levies. No, look. So it's only the big centers that actually make money out of RSC levies. And that all went, and that is why district municipalities were formed, so that they could get the RSC levy. And they could distribute it, but now it's all to all municipalities, so it's a totally different scene altogether. And I'm saying, you know, if you're going to have monies paid to the district municipalities, rather share that between that for the little municipality that hasn't got the income.
The argument that we talk about in terms of this municipality-based income-generating activity also needs political decisions to be taken, because certain municipalities, because of their past history, you know, it's, if you actually just open up and leave them to be open, they may possibly use that as blocking integration and all these sorts of things, or even perpetuating separate development in the municipality. And then you know, it's the business there, the business levy that you refer to. You know, because South Africa is united. You know, you wouldn't politically take decisions that create a precedent, which then other municipalities, even in the court of law, can argue that why can't we do it? Because Municipality Act is doing it. But when you allow this municipality to do it, it actually milks its poor residents up to the bone, and then you have also the create other problems. So you have got that balance of that includes political decisions to actually maintain integration and transformation and all that.
Yeah.
So there are other sound economic decisions, but which politically they are not sound.
Yeah. But then I see that
there is this balance.
I would see that, Honorable Mashile, but in terms of the municipal fiscal powers and functions, which is also another issue that one has to think about when you think about these local taxes, because they are allowed in terms of that municipal fiscal powers and functions act. So the idea is, if you apply for a tax in terms of that, there are certain criteria that it should actually satisfy. Yeah. And that, as a commission, we apply our minds to. But there are also other principles that we as a commission have actually decided that we're going to also test it against this. For example, you know, when the economy is in a state that it is now, you would actually give that, take that into consideration. What state are we in and are we at in terms of the economic cycle? Are we up there or are we down there? And so those decisions basically will matter. So you've got to think about it, even though it's not in the law, it's something that is important to take into consideration. Now, one would have a problem when a municipality applies for a tax but then says it must be a national tax, because it's no longer. If you want it to be a national tax, then that's like a national competence to do that. Yes, so if SAHCA, for example, though, if SAHCA comes in and says you want to apply for a tax for all municipalities, state municipalities, but those municipalities should have control over the tax rate and the tax base for that tax that would have been approved. Then it becomes a local tax in terms of the intentions of that assignment in the constitution. It can't be, because otherwise if it's a national tax, one rate, one base, one person controls it. So why must we then say national government must introduce that tax?
Okay.
So these are questions that we must actually ask and find answers to.
And actually quite difficult question.
Very.
Just on conditional grants, just to remind you that each conditional grant has got a series of conditions that's attached to the grant. So each grant has got its own grant framework. So if you are exercising oversight, say for example, of a transport department, if you go to the Division of Revenue Act, you will actually see what conditions attach to that particular grant. Right? And I think that is quite useful for knowing what the grant is supposed to have been trying to achieve. You'll also see that on the next slide, I've just got some of the pieces of legislation that govern intergovernmental fiscal relations, you know, like the Division of Revenue Act, Systems Act, PVMA, etc., just to raise awareness around that. And to just say that, you know, if you look at who's all involved in the budget process, quite a number of different players. For example, the Minister's Committee on the Budget in Cabinet, then this Budget Forum, Local Government, MinMet, Provincial Treasuries, National Treasuries, Department of Cooperative Government, National Assembly and NCOP Committees, nine provincial legislatures, the SARS, the Budget Council, and us as well. So it's actually quite a complicated process with a large amount of players involved. The last thing that I just want us to look at before we break would be to just look at the MCBPS 2011 Division of Revenue proposal. So this was made in October as a guideline to what they thought would be happening in October. Now, when the minister changes his budget, there might be changes to this, right? But what we see is that national allocations were supposed to be 410 billion, provincial 384, of which conditional grants were 76 billion, and the majority was actually equitable share, and local government allocation 77 billion. Right? So this is where the MTBPS basically stops. Okay, it stops at very high level allocations. It doesn't really go into detail, which the budget would go into. But what we see there is the vertical division that we basically talked about, right? This changes to the baseline. Does anybody know what they mean by baseline? Any thoughts? So this is in October. The baseline would then be the budget that was in February, right? And you can see that if you look at changes to the baseline, national allocations 1.9, it means that in October they were foreseeing 1.9 billion more than what they had done in February budget. So you can see whether the allocations, you see that the allocations are generally revised upwards rather than revised, very seldom that they actually revised downwards. No, they're not. but
the increase of the baseline is 4.1.
Yeah. Yeah, but provinces would say, yeah, but look at our costs. Yeah, but provinces would basically say, but look at our salary increases. They've increased at a higher rate. Look at the cost of water and electricity and, you know. So, you know, if you look at these numbers, you can see that effort has been made to at least try and protect the provinces and local government. But it's all relative to how costs have also escalated during that period. Okay, any final comments that people want to make at this stage? Thoughts, reflections? Okay, then for me, it's just to sum up what we did today.
Mm-hmm. I mean, like as we have indicated,
but the vertical divisions, is that there is no more political divisions or political accountability that plays the game. But like as you said, as I tried to request a one-page analysis of the, you know, the trend of the, but it looks like one could pick it up on page 30. It looks like we already have those figures there. And then one can just simply look at them and be informed. Although that, like as I've already indicated, there is a distortion of this line of unallocated funds, you know, it's there. And the pattern of the contingency is there. It actually distorts these figures.
Unallocated fund in most cases arises as a result of the overruns that the revenue service makes. So if
we used to make,
yes,
but it might be declining now.
Even now it's declining. But so you find that there's a build up of that, but when you go into the next year, that actually now becomes part and parcel of either the adjustment budget or, but it's only unallocated at the beginning of the year. So it's not the same, it's not exactly the same as the contingency reserve. So you can actually separate it because it's really about, because once the budget has been finalized, the numbers from SARS, the final numbers actually come in way after. So they can come in beyond. You see, at some point, you know, it's actually interesting that at some point we were calling for an entity that would actually test some of these assumptions that you get. And we actually ran into a not so nice discussion with the minister. The minister, in fact, just went to Parliament and said, they only brought it here, we never discussed it, so let's not even consider it in this discussion. So that's fine, but it's one of those things that if you cannot consistently beat the market and beat yourself in the process, especially if you are a revenue authority. So we know very well that there were some efficiency gains, serious efficiency gains with SARS, and also like a lot of people coming into the TaxNet, being awareness and awareness of their responsibility for paying taxes, unlike the Greeks. So a lot of people basically came into the TaxNet, even though I hear that there's quite a substantial amount that are still outside. But it's really, there was something that was happening there, which resulted in this consistent or serial overrun that we almost thought. Also, the kind of gap between what is the forecast set and what you actually end up getting was not really, it was beginning to say, is this their purpose around this thing? Not to say that there's anything sinister about it, but just looking at the trend, we were beginning to query that. And looking at other countries like England that had established such kinds of entities to look at some of these forecasts that that were being, not that they did anything different, or the results maybe, yeah. But the idea is an idea that's across the world. I mean, most countries actually now have that kind of an entity that double checks those, and also interrogates the assumptions under those kinds of forecasts. There's nothing wrong with that. So we think it's still a good idea. And I suspect that it's a question of time before we can actually get to that. But given the fact that SARS has gone that much further in terms of getting people who are supposed to be in the net into the net, and also given the fact that because you can only benefit this much from efficiency gains, these things tend to stabilize over time. So we wouldn't expect those kinds of differences, and maybe over time, these kinds of unallocated funds will become less and less, because it's really a function of the gap between what is the actual outcome and what was yeah.
So what we covered today is we looked a lot at the fiscal outlook, in other words, how the economy impacts on these NDF projections. And we also spent quite a lot of time dealing thoroughly with the fiscal framework, pointing out that it's not just revenue, it's revenue relative to expenditure, and also the contingency reserve issues. Just to say thanks for the degree of participation from members, even though we suffered a bit of dislocation and we were kicked out of our homeland and we were sent into exile. I think that, we managed to actually focus. I haven't managed to cover budget review and recommendations report, but I will speak to Mr. Saboni and say that if you want to invite us back to do budget review and recommendations reports at some other time, we'll make ourselves available. Oh, okay. So we'll be in touch. Obviously, it depends on your schedule, which is like very busy. But hopefully, sometime closer to the time when you have to submit it, we can have another session to just look at the budget review and recommendations report.
Okay,
thank you.
We did have consensus over that, but the original proposal I made was
Okay, can I just make sure that everybody signs our attendance register? Have you signed it? Because what we'll do is we will Henry will think you have your schedule full, and I also think that the other committees need to be getting more involved in this fiscal oversight function. You've got your hands full. I stop. And you need other committees to be doing some of the work on the budget review.
I'm not going to be able to do it.